This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu. This episode is brought to you in part by Regent College, Vancouver, Canada. Experience God's call to a life more abundant with our 1 to 2 week summer courses. Sign up today at rgnt.net/summer.
Welcome to The Russell Moore Show. I'm Ashley Hales, the producer of The Russell Moore Show, and today we get to talk with Russell about his books. We have one of these about every quarter, and today we're talking about Russell's favorite books of 2023. If you already receive his newsletter, that's great. If you don't, if you're watching on YouTube or you're listening on your podcast app, we want to encourage you to sign up for his newsletter at russellmoore.com, because then you will have already received his top 10 book list. So that's a great way to get connected. And we want to say thanks, of course, to all of the CT Book Award winners, particularly Chris Watkin. Biblical Critical Theory was the CT Book of the Year. We had Chris on earlier, I think in March of this year. So what do you think of Biblical Critical Theory?
Well, it's an amazing book, well-deserved CT Book of the Year. And it, you know, I wish it were named something different, because I think there are a lot of people who could really benefit from the book who think it's about some sort of an analysis of theory.
Right.
in a way that it's not. And I think there are some people who think that they have to be an expert on certain things in order to read the book. Or people, I've heard a lot of people who say, wow, it's so big that I don't know if I could get through it. And I say, yeah, but it's one of those books where you can go to the section that you're interested in, mm-hmm. and you're not going to be lost. You can really gain from that. So I think it's really a helpful book to have.
It is. It's a fantastic book. My husband actually gave it away to his elders for a Christmas present as well. So it's a great reference book as well. But we want to talk particularly about the things that you are working on and working through. We have some memoirs. We have some social and historical commentary, some sermons, a graphic novel, a biography. So I'm going to read your top 10 books of 2023, Russell, and listeners, if you're like frantically trying to scribble things down, don't worry. All of these, of course, will be in the show notes. And then we'll spend a little bit of time talking through some of the themes that all 10 books kind of bring us towards. So you have several books, as we think about different themes, that really are kind of working through this interaction between politics and Christianity and history. Several of your books really are drawing to that theme. We had Tobias Kremer on talking about The Godless Crusade, which in that book, right, he's describing the ways in which Christian symbolism has kind of been co-opted by these nationalistic agendas, kind of historically and globally. And we also have Tim Alberta's book, and he has been recently on the show, on The Kingdom, the Power, and the Glory, talking about white evangelicals in America and how they've kind of traded the gospel for political influence. As you think about those two books in conversation, The Godless Crusade and The Kingdom, The Power and the Glory, what are you hopeful readers of those two books will really come away with?
Well, they're very different reading experiences for mm-hmm. me personally. I'm surprised that I read Tim's book mm-hmm. because I'm a character in it. You know, it's one of those things where I don't, just as a kind of self-protection mechanism or a keeping my mind together mechanism, I never read any articles about me at all. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. And so there are all kinds of things. Now, Maria does, but I don't read them. And yep. So there are a lot of things that when I was reading through it, I would be thinking, oh, yeah, I forgot mm-hmm. about that. But it was a initially kind of wary reaction mm-hmm. to it, mm-hmm. but he handled so accurately the situation, but also kind of tied things together in terms of storytelling mm-hmm. in ways that ultimately were, I think, really beautiful mm-hmm. and that I was able to look at and to say, this is beautiful. I mean, really, mm-hmm. it really does. And it ends in a dark place, but I think there's a hopeful place to it too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Tobias's book, the thing about that was so good is because his research has been massively important for me in understanding what's going on around mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. And to have it distilled and put together in one book, that was really helpful as well. And, you know, on this show, when we had him on, mm-hmm. I found out that he's the grandson of a confessing church mm-hmm. pastor in Germany who mm-hmm. was almost killed for defying the Nazi regime, mm-hmm. which, you know, really puts, I think that, you know, he doesn't talk about that in the book, but in both of those books, you have a personal aspect. Because yeah. Tim, in his book, is talking about his dad, who's a pastor, mm-hmm. and a lot of the experiences going on in that church. And Tobias has this backstory that's really courageous and heroic and mm-hmm. something of what we're going to need throughout the world in mm. the days to come, I think.
Mm. Either through their narrative arc or through kind of the wide-rangingness of Tobias's book, is there a sense in which, you know, as we read and engage with these stories and as we hear of, you know, political movements and changes shifting so drastically, that we kind of can find ourselves like in a better spot instead of some of maybe the fear mongering or this kind of shouting across the aisles that seems to be so rampant in American life these days?
I told somebody yesterday, and I was quoting the old Edward Abbey quote, I'm a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist. And by short-term, I mean the next 5,000 years. And I said, it's not quite that way. I'm a long-term optimist, meaning I'm really hopeful and excited about where things are 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. I'm really apprehensive about the next 5 years. It's the way that we get to the other side of this. We have to go through it. We can't go right. around
yep.
it.
Yeah.
And so I think there will be an ongoing sort of assessment of where we are. And then that also will play into what I think will be a retrospective of this time of, mm-hmm. of looking back. I mean, that was one of the things I said when I was reading Tim Alberta's book. Mm-hmm. I finished it and I looked at Maria and I said, wow, that time in our lives was a lot. Yeah. She said, you think? and but it was like, okay, it's one thing to live through it. It's another thing to have it all together right yeah, there in front of you and to see it yeah. all together. And I think that's going to be the case just for this whole time period yeah. when people look back and try to write and explain, okay, what did COVID do? What did, right. you know, secularization, church decline, what did it do, all of these things put together, yeah, mm-hmm. there's going to be a lot to look at.
Yeah. You know, and as we think about, you have Mark Knoll's book, another historian on your list about C.S. Lewis's reception in America amidst Catholics, mainline Protestants, and evangelicals before World War II. What new thing, we know that you are quite a big Lewis fan, but what new thing do you learn in that book, and how might that help us muddle through maybe these next several dark and gloomy times?
Well, you know, one of the things, and if people are watching on YouTube, mm-hmm. they might see mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis with, I put a Santa hat on him behind me. I think one of the things that this book was really helpful with is showing the long-term nature of, you know, to come to Eugene Peterson that we'll talk about later, that long obedience in the same direction. Mm-hmm. Because what the book really does is to show a completely different reception of C.S. Lewis as he was alive and writing from the way that we see him now. And, right. and even in terms of, you know, often there's a kind of British Christians are sometimes mystified by how many of us Americans are so devoted to C.S.
Right,
Lewis.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, this book shows how that was not the case when he was mm-hmm. writing. And it right. certainly wasn't the case that you had evangelical Christians like me, part of the Lewis fanboy club mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Mm-hmm. Instead, what you had, Noel talks about, the mainline Protestant audience, the Catholic audience, and the evangelical audience. And his argument is Lewis was best received by the Catholic audiences mm-hmm. and least well received by the evangelical audiences. Mm-hmm. And it was mm-hmm. kind of interesting to read in there why. Mm-hmm. And so you would have some of the things that I would expect would be problems with Lewis, but there were other things that were surprising, like mm-hmm. Lewis's understanding of adoption, the doctrine mm-hmm. of adoption, mm-hmm. which is fairly straightforward and mm-hmm. not that controversial now, mm-hmm. but was for a lot of people then. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of shows how an immediate response to something does not necessarily tell you mm-hmm. what the actual response is going to be. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about somebody who maybe, you know, leads a small group or teaches a Sunday school class or does a prison ministry or something like that, sometimes you can think, am I really doing anything? Am I just yeah. sort of just speaking into the wind here? And we tend to forget how usually what happens, we're completely oblivious to how God's using it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was certainly the case with Lewis. And mm-hmm. as I was reading this book, it just made me think about that and how God works.
Mm-hmm. And just how stories, right, stick with us and kind of take up residence and resonance for, like, generationally.
Well, yeah, and that's the David Brooks book that mm-hmm. I have on the list, How to Know a Person. He talks about the difference between what he calls paradigmatic thinking and narrative mm-hmm. thinking. Mm-hmm. And paradigmatic thinking is what analyzes data
right.
and information. And narrative thinking actually follows a storyline and mm-hmm. hits at not just the intellectual, but also the affective. And I think that's what was powerful about Lewis's writing, is that you had, in some cases, a completely narrative mm-hmm. sort of mm-hmm. approach. You think of the Narnia books. And Lewis said, I'm intentionally doing this because so many people are overly familiar mm-hmm. in a way. They've heard the gospel so many times that they don't even respond to it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to hit them from the side mm-hmm. with it. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's not explicitly narrative, but it actually is. Just with the way that he's mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the way that he's talking and the way he's using metaphor, making analogies. The end of Surprised by Joy, in which he talks about longing, and he compares that with being hungry.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that being hungry is pointing you to the fact that mm-hmm. there actually is food and you need yeah. food, and that this sort of spiritual kind of longing does the same thing. I mean, that sticks mm-hmm. with a person, I think, for mm-hmm. a long time. Certainly does for me.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore.
So you have a graphic novel of Watership Down. So tell us what that experience was like reading that and how that made your top 10 this year, Russell.
Well, I am not a huge devotee of Watership Down. I mean, I liked it. I read it, but I'm not one of those people. I have friends who have read Watership Down over and over and really resonate with it.
Yeah.
I don't. But I thought when I saw this graphic novel, I thought, you know, how are they going to do this with this really dark book? And I think I talked about it in the newsletter how one time I was talking to somebody who said, oh, yeah, I read Watership Down. It was so sweet. And I'm thinking, sweet. And then we realize ultimately that this person was thinking of Velveteen Rabbit.
And different rabbits.
Very different rabbit. So I thought, will this graphic novel be able to capture that? And it does. I mean, it's beautifully illustrated. And it's able to get at the sense of darkness and peril, even just the way that facial expressions are used and landscapes are used. It was just an exceptionally well done sort of translation of Watership Down into a new medium.
So you have some memoirs on here, Beth Moore's, Esau Macaulay's. You also have the biography of King.
The King biography is taking a historical figure and putting the figure into context and and sort of giving you this sweep of a life from an outside kind of perspective, a historian's perspective. And in that case, I mean, there are some biographies that I just don't like to get because I feel like I already know this story too well. So, you know, Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or Martin Luther King or John F. Kennedy is another one. It's similar to that. And so I'll think, you know, is there anything really here that I'm going to learn? And I've been surprised several times with the fact that there can be. I mean, there was this magnificent biography of Lincoln a few years ago, A. Lincoln, that was just like, oh, I mean, there's completely new insight here. And this King biography was similar. I mean, it was really, he was using a lot of new sources that people wouldn't have had access to in the past, and also was just really good at storytelling. And so that's a very different thing than the memoirs, where you have, in Beth Moore's case, you have the memoir of a life. She's telling the story of her life. In Esau's case, he's telling the story of a family. So he's included in it, but it's a story of several generations. And both of those were really powerful. I mean, I kind of like with with some of those biographies, I felt like, well, I mean, I know Beth, so I know her story. So I was expecting to, you know, have a few moments of surprise, but I was really struck by not just all the new things that I found in this book, all the ways that it resonated with me in terms of experiences that she went through in an Arkansas context that translate over to what I experienced in a Mississippi context. And then for it, it's just really beautifully written. Esau's book, likewise, is I said when I read it, I did the blurb for it and said, I think this is the best thing he's ever written.
It's fantastic.
And it, you know, he has written some really good stuff, but it's powerful because it's not just history. What he's doing is there's a very personal part to it. And the part that I found the most moving about that book was Esau talking about his father and the absence of his father and the way that sometimes he would, I don't know, overcorrect is not the right word, but he would be in this cycle of constantly trying to prove that he wasn't his dad.
Yeah.
In the way that he was being present for his kids, that he realized actually was kind of keeping him from being present with his kids. And that was a really key insight, something I'd never thought about before. And the way he talked about it, that sense of performance, not in the sense of fakery, but sometimes the sense of I've got to be on this treadmill and prove that I'm able to do it. I think he really explained that beautifully. And then Beth's memoir, I mean, it's kind of similar to the Tim Alberta one, having lived through something and then reading it. I mean, she and I lived through the same time period together, especially that time period after the release of the Access Hollywood tapes. And so getting to that part and sort of experiencing her experience of it was powerful for me.
Did the reading of those two memoirs teach you something about vulnerability or thinking about how to show up in your own writing and work?
Yeah, I mean, I think both of those memoirs were vulnerable without being morbid.
Yeah,
I guess
right.
I'm sort of searching for a word here, but both of them came with the right kind of vulnerability that, if you think of Andy Crouch's Weak and Strong, that the kind of vulnerability that comes with authority.
Yeah.
I thought that was present in both of those memoirs.
Right. It wasn't like a tell-all scandalous sort of thing, even though they're both dealing with quite hard-hitting subjects, right? But, you know, there's a way in which they're telling a bigger story through even some of the suffering and the hardship.
Yeah, and they're telling a complex story because in neither of these books do you have a, even when they're talking about really hard and difficult times, it's mixed in with all of the genuine affection and gratitude and all of those things, which is, of course, the way that all of us ultimately, when we look back on our lives, everything is going to be affected by sin and regret and loss. And yet there are flashes of God's grace all through that too. And they were able to keep those together in a way that I think would help. I think that either of these books would help people who have completely different experiences, be able to feel what it is that they're talking about in a way that actually will help them make sense of their own experiences.
And you think about David Brooks's book, How to Know a Person, which we mentioned briefly before, you know, thinking about the ways in which that kind of comes at some of those same themes and questions, the way that maybe you could think of Beth and Esau demonstrating, right, that that Brooks's book in some ways tells us how to do that. It tells us how to actually be present with people. What did you learn from that book? What were some of your takeaways?
I feel like this book was doing a similar thing that Esau and mm-hmm. Beth's book is doing mm-hmm. it, but doing it in a very David Brooksy way.
Yeah.
which is not memoir. It's right. looking at culture and psychology and so forth. So mm-hmm. I see in this book kind of similar to Road to Character and mm-hmm. Second Mountain, his previous books. You take those three together, they're very different. And he even mm-hmm. mentions this in the book. He did Bobo's in Paradise several years ago about the bourgeois bohemians.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious and great. Insightful because mm-hmm. he was really seeing and looking at a trend and explaining it. But something has changed and mm-hmm. deepened for David in which mm-hmm. he's able to kind of work through these questions of meaning mm-hmm. and moral formation in these books. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was doing a similar thing. I think that maybe even in ways that aren't apparent to him, mm-hmm. there's been growth and mm-hmm. deepening of maturity and meaning in ways that come out in these books. And I mean, not to say, I mean, he's always been brilliant. Everything that he's written has been worth reading, but there's a different way of coming at it now for him that I think is moving.
Yes, it is.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying and sirens go off and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
We have Tara Isabella Burton's book called Self-Made, where she talks mm-hmm. about how we have this kind of self-made identity, and it's kind of overblown all the way from Da Vinci to the Kardashians. It's a fun book. I really appreciated just the ways in which she's saying it's not that we are unspiritual in the sense of what does increased secularization look like, maybe something like Charles Taylor would talk about, but rather what we really have is just kind of this movement, you know, that spiritualization has now moved kind of to the individual, whether it's crystals. Someone was telling me that like Gen Z and Gen Alpha, like they're all into crystals and tarot card readings and kind of all of these alternate forms of spirituality. And so we see that spiritual impulse hasn't left us. But what did you enjoy about this book, Self-Made?
Well, I mean, first of all, she's a really good writer.
Mm-hmm. She is.
So she's a really good thinker and a really mm-hmm. good writer as well. And at least for me, one of the ways that I really know that a book is helping me mm-hmm. is when there are parts of it where I say, oh, I've seen that, but I didn't know that I was seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you once you kind of look at it from the grid that the mm-hmm. writer is giving, mm-hmm. you're able to say, oh, I'm making sense of something that I actually have seen but didn't know how to articulate. And she does that really well. She did that really well in her last book, Strange Rites, and she does it really well in this one too. And you're right. She says it's not that we're living in a secularizing time, meaning a subtraction of God. It means that we're changing gods, and the God that is present in so much of modern life is the internal God. And she goes through to show kind of how that happens. So if you pair this book with the Brooks book, I mean, David talks about helping people to see the storyline of their lives and to tell their story. But he's talking about doing that in community.
Right. Not performative.
Performative, and also not self-delusional. And what she's talking about is a writing of one's story almost ex nihilo. And as a matter of fact, as I think about it now, I didn't think about it before, but as I think about it now, David in his book talks about kind of going back and editing one's life story and about being able to see, okay, these were things that I can put in a different context than what was present before. That's a very different thing than creating a self out of air. And that's what this book is about. And she shows how it happens. And one of the things that was encouraging to me in reading this book too is the book does not say, oh, there are some kinds of people that this affects. Look at those people who are doing that. She's saying, this is the culture we're inhabiting right now, so it affects all of us. And the question is going to be, does it affect us in ways that we can see or in ways that are invisible to us, which is the more dangerous of the two? So it's a really, I think, a helpful book.
What do you think? How would you answer that question, Russell?
Yeah, I don't think we're able to see a lot of it. Because, I'm trying to even think of who I was reading the other day. Might have been Taylor in Sources of the Self, in which he was talking about how it's impossible to be able to understand how a medieval person experienced the world.
Yeah.
And so it's really not possible completely for a modern person, even a believer, to know what it was like for Martin Luther to be anguished, because he was looking at it through a distinctly medieval way of thinking, the way the culture is around him, and we are in this completely other context, and so it affects the kinds of questions we ask, the things that we just think, well, this is just life. Rather than saying, oh, something is happening here. And so I think it is largely invisible to us. And that's one of the reasons why it's helpful to be asking constantly, okay, what is going on and am I being shaped by it? So that Romans 12, conform to the pattern of this world. In order to understand that, you have to understand what the world is that you're living in right now. And that will explain how you're conforming to it sometimes in ways that you don't even think about or know.
Until, we get a little bit broader view. I've just started picking up Andrew Wilson's Remaking the World about 1776, which is, he's a British author, but he's writing about how democracy and empire and so many different ways of being in the world, of course, shifted around that year, but putting so many different themes kind of together to help elucidate a larger whole. So anyway, that's it.
I'll have to pick that up. I am reading right now, rereading the Adams Jefferson letters.
Oh, fun. Are you singing Hamilton as you go?
They are amazing, these letters back and forth from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, because you have these two genius level, brilliant minds, but right. very different personalities.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
in a time when letter writing was yeah. just very different than the world we inhabit. And it just, it's about everything from losing one's hearing uh-huh. to religious opinions uh-huh. to, you know, oh, is everything just falling apart? I mean, there's just so much in it that's...
That is really fun. So many of us have really appreciated the life and work of Eugene Peterson, and we have this posthumously released collection of sermons, Light's a Lovely Mile. Tell us, you know, is that something that you have been reading just kind of on your own, bit by bit? Is it a devotional reading, or did you just make your way through that? What does your reading life look like with Peterson's book, and what have you enjoyed about that one?
I read it straight through because... Mm-hmm. I would read everything that I could that mm-hmm. Eugene Peterson wrote, and I find him to be such a remarkable writer and preacher.
Yeah.
And one of the things about this collection of sermons is there's not a lot of distance between his preaching and his writing. Mm-hmm. And so there are just insights in there that are, you know, I think I mentioned in the list, there's a sermon on Simon the Magician mm-hmm. from Acts that's mm-hmm. just astoundingly good. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of similar themes of things that Peterson has talked about elsewhere. But I think in this one, what you really see close up is the fact that he was pastoring this group of people, Bel Air Presbyterian Church. He was enmeshed in those mm-hmm. particular lives. And I think you get to see it through the mm-hmm. through the sermons here.
Mm. You know, as we kind of wrap up, we think about there's just so many great themes about, like, what does it look like to be present, right? To be present in community and churches, or what does it look like to not only be present in your pain, whether that's generational or personal, but to also hold tight to redemption. You know, what does it look like to actually be present with another person, with Brooks as well as Burton's books? So I think that those are all really big themes, I think, as we think about how we might show up in 2024.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I hadn't thought about the common themes until this conversation, but there are several.
Yeah.
Overlaps there.
Well, that's what you get for having a, you know, an English PhD as your producer is. Let's talk about it thematically. What are you looking forward to reading next year, Russell?
I don't know what is going to be coming in 2024. I do know that I'm reading right now because I was with a group of friends who were talking about this book, The Three Body Problem, mm-hmm. which is a Chinese science fiction book, and it's the kind of thing I would have never thought I would want to read.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My friends were saying, you have to read it and don't give up, because you'll want to give up about a fourth of the way through, and then you'll want to give up about halfway through. Keep going.
Okay.
And they were right. I mean, it's a fascinating book, and so I'm starting the second volume, Dark okay. Forest.
Well, we'll look forward to chatting more about books in the new year for sure. And thank you for giving all of our listeners so many great books to think about as we wind down 2023.
Well, thank you for the excellent leadership that you give us on this show in producing and leading. And I'm very grateful.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosper. Host, Russell Moore. Producer, Ashley Hales. Associate producers, Abby Perry and Mackenzie Hill. Director of Operations for CT Media, Matt Stevens. Audio engineering provided by Dan Phelps. Video producer is Abby Egan. And the theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.